This is James Ponsel, the director of The End of the Tour, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Adam Sharkoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 308. I know I keep pushing back Jerry Schatzberg. I apologize for that. If you're waiting for the Jerry Schatzberg episode, I believe Monday, I'm going to do a bonus episode next week just to finally put that up. It's way late. I keep pushing it back because of what commonly happens, where more deadlines encroach, and I got to get other episodes and segments up. So I apologize for that. People are definitely waiting for the conversation with Jerry Schatzberg. And don't worry, it's going to definitely be worth the wait. It's a lot of fun. This episode, number 308, is also a lot of fun. First up is Colin Geddes, who is one of the programmers. He's a senior programmer at the Toronto International Film Festival, which will be running from September 10th through the 20th in just a few weeks. And Colin has been heading up the Midnight Madness and Vanguard sections of the festival. He's the lead programmer on those two sections. And, it was, I think, they're one of the first festivals to include this type of, you know, what we call genre films and that type of thing in the festival, and to make a special category for that. And now a lot of festivals are typically doing that. And so I'm not sure. Maybe there were other festivals. I'm not talking about festivals that already were oriented around genre films. I'm talking about mainstream festivals. So he's going to talk about that, and also the specific some specific films that will be in the 2015 festival. I have every intention of getting up there for at least a few days this year and checking it out myself. Thank you, Colin, for coming on the show. We Skyped with him from Toronto, and it's just a brief conversation, and we'll go to that in just a couple of minutes. And then we're going to meet Sam De Jong, who is from Amsterdam. He has a film. It's called Prince. It's sort of a hybrid of different genres too. It's kind of a comedy. It's kind of a drama. I don't know. It's hard to classify, frankly, which is a nice thing, you know. But it holds together. There is a center to it. And it's follows the main character, this young fellow named Ayub. It's a dazzling little film, and Sam is going to be on to talk about the film, and the fact that Vice Media is one of the producers of the film, as is an outfit called 100% Halal, which I think is a company from the Netherlands. I'm pretty sure that's the case, and we're gonna learn all about that as well. And that film will be opening on Friday in New York City, Friday the 14th, and then in L.A. as well, I think, and on demand, all I think, today, Friday. If any luck, the show will post on Friday. I've been very busy. It's a beautiful summer. Every day seems more spectacular than the next, and a lot of wonderful things going on here, and I'm very happy to still be doing the podcast for you. And thank you for listening to it. Last up today is also this lovely woman. Her name is Gina Lebrecht, or Liebrecht, but she goes by Lebrecht. She worked with Les Blank. And, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that Maureen Gosling has been on a couple of times. And she also was a very close colleague of Les Blank's. Well, Gina is yet another. And right now at the Film Forum, they are playing a film that the two worked on together. I believe Gina was the editor, which is called How to Smell a Rose, which was sort of a collaboration between Gina and Les with one of the forefather pioneers of Verite cinema here in the United States, and his name was Ricky Leacock, who often collaborated himself with D.A. Pennebaker, who is a former guest on the show. But Ricky died a few years ago, and since then, so has, unfortunately, very sadly, Les Blank. So we're losing this generation, which I really feel sad about, because, you know, they had so much innovation, and, you know, nobody did these types of films before them. And we've lost, in the space of just a short amount of time, Ricky Leacock, Al Maisels, Robert Drew, Ed Pincus, and Les Blank. And it's a male-dominated, obviously, group. Well, right there in the trenches even though she was at least a generation, if not two, younger, is Gina Lebrecht. And Gina will be talking about her relationship with Les Blank and her experiences shooting this and making this film about Ricky Leacock in France some time ago. And right now, as I was beginning to say, at the Film Forum, you can watch How to Smell a Rose and also the Ricky Leacock film, short film called Happy Mother's Day, which is a kind of a companion piece, which we're going to discuss, so you'll know what I'm talking about in a few minutes when you listen to that conversation as we enter into the dog days of summer. All right, folks, let's pop into the show right now. This is a conversation with one of the programmers, specifically for Midnight Madness and the Vanguard's portions of TIFF, or Toronto International Film Festival. And his name is Colin Geddes.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks. Colin Geddes, who is the one of the programmers. How long have you been a programmer at TIFF?
Oh, Lordy. Since 1998.
That's not possible.
It's a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, ever since I moved to Toronto, which was around 1989, 1988, I've been in the audience for the film festival. My first week in Toronto, I actually stood in line for the first year of Midnight Madness, and that was my first taste of the film festival. And every September, I would go back, and in essence, TIFF, or back then when it was called the Festival of Festivals, was my film school. Mm-hmm. I was studying graphic design, and I didn't have film programming in my radar as a career option at all, but every September I would just overdose and see films from around the world. And that's what really kind of paved the way for my career. I just got very involved, very vocal about the films that I liked, and I started doing a fanzine on Hong Kong films that no one else was writing about at the time. And that got me in the attention of the powers that be at TIFF and the press department and the programming. And in 1997, Noah Cowan, who was the programmer looking after the Midnight Madness series, asked me to be a co-programmer. And in 98, he gave me the full series, and I've been programming ever since.
So are you saying, like, as of 98, Midnight Madness existed, or...?
The Midnight Madness started in 1988. Get my math right. I believe it is... Yeah, because that's when I came to Toronto. It was 88, and Midnight Madness was started within TIFF, or as it was known then, like I said, the Festival of Festivals. They were realizing that there were films that were not getting programmed within art film festivals because people kind of looked down on them, but at the same time, these were really, they're still valid films. Right? And they were still art. Mm-hmm. And so they opened up this forum for genre and maybe more kind of B or exploitive films, and it really, really grew. And also, in many ways, the Midnight Madness program is kind of ground zero for new audience members. If you're daunted by foreign films, by masters, by art house, well, everyone understands kung fu and zombies and ghosts. So let's get you started there and kind of branch out and experience more parts of the festival.
And if Kevin Smith is involved, you might have all three in one movie, actually.
You never know.
You never know?
Usually, actually, no, I would default to Takeshi Miike.
Okay, well, you know, I'm glad you brought him up, because this is the director most people may remember, Audition, which
yep.
got actors out of the acting business. And he's back with a new film, and it's called Love.
Nope. That's
Gaspar
Noé.
That's
Noé.
Gaspar Noé's film.
Oh, man. You must be terrible on dates. Oh. It's like, hey, let's go see this fun film. Let's buy this French director. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you've scarred your date. And you're thinking, what signals am I putting out? No, but I was looking up the few of the titles and obviously just got them confused. But I'm a big fan of both of those guys. Enter the Void is also one of my favorites.
So the difference in where those films fall within TIFF. So let me backtrack here, and I'll explain a little bit of Midnight Madness. So Midnight Madness, as the title suggests, every film within the series starts at midnight. One film throughout the duration of the film festival, every day of the film festival, so that's a total of 10 films. These films are programmed specifically, it's a very different criteria than many other festivals. I program films in the Midnight Madness selection. The mission, the mandate, is to wake you up. You've seen one, two, three, maybe four films throughout the day during the film festival. This is your last stop, and I'm not going to have you fall asleep with a slow-burn thriller. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you action, shock, chills, black humor that starts off in the first 15 minutes and keeps on going for the next 90 minutes to 2 hours to keep you going. So,
That and Red Bull.
Exactly. Now, the other section that I look after is the Vanguard selection.
Right.
Now, the Vanguard selection is an interesting one where it's all about the intersection between art house and genre. So these are films which are dark, edgy, dangerous, sexy, films that are kind of pushing boundaries a little bit, but it's a little bit more, let's put it this way, the festival audience starts with Midnight Madness and then grows into Vanguard.
Right.
Midnight Madness is more about the extremes, and Vanguard is more about the subtlety, kind of the elevated genre, if you will.
Maybe Vanguard is pushing the envelope, and maybe Midnight Madness is digesting the envelope, or
exploding
the envelope. Yeah,
tearing it up. Yeah.
Well, they both look like great great selections of films, or include great selections of films. One of the films in the Vanguard section that is of particular interest to me, because I've done a series of podcast segments devoted to it, is The Missing Girl. It also happens to be an American film, but I was glad to see you included that.
Yeah, A.D., the director of that film, A.D. Calvo, I followed him for a while. And, I mean, he's had a very interesting career, a very kind of self-started filmmaker. And his previous films have been more in kind of horror genre.
Yeah.
And the competition for Midnight Madness, honestly, is very competitive. It's international. It's not exclusively horror films. It's, as I said, black comedies or action films or thrillers. And his films were good, but just didn't quite go the next level. And he then embarked on a new film called Missing Girl and kept in touch with me over the course of the production of the film, and has delivered a really good, almost dare I say, quaint mumblecore thriller, for lack of a better word, about a kind of a schlubby comic book store owner. He's kind of a bit of a stunted adult, emotionally stunted, and he becomes obsessed with a girl who's working in his store, and a little too obsessed. And when she disappears, he thinks the worst and starts taking matters into his own hands. And this film really, really surprised me. It shows a director growing in his craft.
I agree with your assessment, yeah. Are there any of the other ones that you're particularly looking forward to showing and presenting to new audiences? I mean, obviously, there's such a small number in these two categories, so I'm sure probably the answer is all of them, but
yeah, I mean, it's hard to, as we say, it's hard to pick our favorite children.
Yeah.
Within the Vanguard selection, there's around 12 films, 12 to 13 films in the Vanguard selection. And in that series, I work with the other programmers. I'm only responsible for six of them, but I work with the other programmers at the festival, and they make selections, bring them to me, and we kind of discuss whether or not we feel they fit in to what we have as the definition of Vanguard. So another film which we have in that selection, I would say, that's worthwhile is Evolution. It's a French film. The director, Lucille, and I have to practice her name. I still have a couple of weeks to practice her last name, and I don't want to botch it on the radio right now.
Before the Q&As.
She's the partner, the romantic partner of Gaspar Noé.
Is that right?
So it's going to be showing Gaspar Noé's film Love, which is a 3D porn film. But then they're kind of almost a yin-yang kind of couple in their visual output.
Oh, and I see where you're a little intimidated. There is probably three times the number of consonants than there are vowels in this name.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be pronouncing, like practicing in front of a mirror and making sure I'm confident on that. Her previous film was one from, I think, almost 7 years ago now, a film called Innocence, which was a really beautiful but kind of enigmatic kind of puzzle box of a film. And this is kind of the same. It's visually just incredibly striking, a shot on kind of sun-bleached, rocky village, coastal village in kind of southern Europe. And it's a village where there's only women and their sons. You realize quickly that there are no men around. Mm. And all of these mothers all have red hair. Hmm. All of the boys are soon taken to a hospital where they're being treated for a sickness. But maybe they're being experimented on. You're not too sure. It's a really kind of very kind of cryptic fairy tale. Mm-hmm. But incredibly striking visuals, and I think it was really going to cast a spell over the audience.
I'm going to give this a try. Lucille Hagihalilovic.
That's pretty good. That's pretty. My wife, who's European, who's Serbian, has a similarly hard to pronounce last name, and she's been putting me through the paces on that. So yeah, Evolution is another film in Vanguard that I'm really looking forward to sharing. We're showing it at the Ryerson, which is one of our biggest venues. And it's a 1,200-seat movie theater.
Nice.
And so it's just going to just be so impressive seeing it big.
I can't wait to see it. Another fellow who filmmaker fellow who has been on my podcast, Jeremy Saulnier. I'm glad to see that's also made it into the Midnight Madness category. Green Room, much anticipated.
Yeah, Green Room I got to see in Cannes. Like I'd seen his previous film, Blue Ruin. And it actually, even backtracking, I was always a fan of his first film, which was a comedy horror outing called Murder Party. And this really shows Jeremy is a very, very, very talented filmmaker because every film he's done is different, very decidedly different. Where Blue Ruin was a very kind of meditative revenge thriller, this one is a straightforward kind of siege thriller along the lines of Assault on Precinct 13. Young punk band touring America, siphoning gas, hard on their luck, lose out on a gig, short on money. They're offered a gig in the middle of a forest at this compound. As long as they don't talk politics, they'll get $350. No questions asked. They go to this gig, and they're performing for basically white supremacists.
You know, if I had a dime for every time that's happened to me.
And things quickly escalate and into a standoff. One of the neat twists on this is the bad guy, the head of the compound, is played in a rare turn as a villain by Patrick Stewart. This is a really, kind of feels like a bit of an 80s action throwback, but it's just small, genuine, and also really shocking.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but great things about it. So, I know I have to let you go in a minute.
No problem.
Yeah, but so Midnight Madness, the festivals, the TIFF runs, Toronto International Film Festival runs from September 10th through the 20th. The Bell Lightbox and several other theaters, including the Ryerson, as you mentioned. And
Midnight Madness starts on the opening night.
Okay, very good.
We're opening with Green Room and the film going throughout the every night of the festival, so 10 films.
Beautiful.
And it's like a really fun audience. I mean, we're actually really highly regarded for the audiences at TIFF, especially for the Midnight Madness, because it's an enthusiastic audience, but I will point out it's not a disrespectful audience. The energy is rambunctious and rowdy, but as soon as the lights go down, one of the most honestly sincere, appreciative cinephile audiences you'll ever find.
And I can second that because I've been in your screenings. So.
Yeah, people have this misconception. It's like, oh, it's like a party. And it's like, no, as soon as the lights are down,
right.
Like,
or
If you say something on your cell phone, you do so at your own risk.
Yeah, or it's a fanboy mentality, but you're right, it's not. It's a very sophisticated audience and a very generous audience.
Yeah, I mean, the directors are often really stunned by the sharp level of questions that we get at 2 o'clock in the morning. Because that's an engaged audience and a really smart audience that, I mean, one of the lucky things we have is that TIFF has really educated this audience over the years on what's good and what's important in world cinema. And so they're there to watch and to ask hard questions.
Thank you, Colin.
No problem.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. All right, take care.
My conversation with Sam de Jong, a nice young filmmaker from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam, regarding this film, Prince, which is open right now. You should go check it out with my complete endorsement. Sam's really a sweet guy, and we had a nice time meeting and talking, and this is what I'm describing right here. Sam de Jong.
In Dutch we say de Jong, but
de Jong.
Here
that's
they
fine.
Say de Jong sometimes. Which
not I. No, no, I know better than that.
Okay.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about yourself and your background. You know, we're here to talk about Prince, which is your film, which is opening Friday.
Yes, correct.
Friday here in New York, right?
Yeah.
Which is the 14th?
Yeah,
yeah,
of August.
Of August. And what theaters, do you know?
AMC.
AMC.
We're releasing it through Film Buff with some theaters of Drafthouse Alamo.
Confusing. This is one of my questions. I'm more interested in the whole the process of getting the film produced and out, because you have, first of all, Vice, right, is your production is the production company got behind.
Yeah, and like Halal.
And Halal, with films. Right, or 100% Halal.
Yeah, 100%
which,
Halal, yeah.
Which I really like. And then Alamo Drafthouse bought for...
Film Buff. Film Buff is the distributor.
Not Drafthouse.
What no, but Drafthouse owns
doing?
Theaters.
Okay. Gotcha.
Don't pin me down on this, but...
It's okay. Everybody's involved in some level.
Yeah.
That's all we know. That's incredible. So how did all that come about? I'm curious.
Yeah, that's like... I'm still a bit blown away by it all. Even you and me having this conversation here in New York, it's...
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. I made, you know... short films. I graduated from film school in Amsterdam as well. Mm-hmm. Then gradually started. The question was, how did I come to making prints, right? I don't know.
I interrupted myself. That's not your fault. I started asking you a little bit about your background.
Yeah.
And then I quickly got reminded about all these different film organizations that wanted to be involved in prints. And then that occupied my mind.
Yeah.
So, but let's back up, like you say, and tell me a little bit about yourself. Then we'll go into the other aspect of the film, which is, you know, the distribution of it.
Yeah. No. So, like I said, I grew up in Amsterdam on the outskirts in a small village. Mm-hmm. But, you know, high school, everything I did in the center of the city. Mm-hmm. And as I graduated from film school... I graduated with a short film, a 21-minute short film called Magnesium.
Yeah.
That got nominated at Sundance. So mm-hmm. that sort of propelled my international... You know, I started meeting people from around the world, which was super inspiring. Once you start traveling with a short film, you meet, like, your
being
world
on festival
opens.
Circuit, of course.
Yeah, yeah, because, yeah, especially coming from a film school where your world exists of you and your five other directors, all of a sudden... You enter this world of beautiful people and beautiful films,
yeah,
and
like this huge brotherhood or
yeah,
sisterhood, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I mean, you can see from Magnesium to Prince, so much changed in the way I started directing.
Yeah.
So
I didn't
really
see Magnesium. I'm sorry to say, and I have to rectify that, because now after seeing Prince, I'm now really interested in seeing Magnesium.
Yeah, it's completely different. Mm-hmm. It's way more serious. I think in a film school, you tend to, you know, I got very uptight and very nervous and very dogmatic and very rigid about the way I directed, because I was so eager to have it succeed because, you know, in film school, four year long, they tell you once you graduate, you know, your graduation film, you either make it or you break it. So you become very tense about it. And I mean, it turned out well, but it didn't turn out as a film in which I saw my own voice as a director that much.
How could you do that so early anyway? Because yeah. It takes time to find your own voice yeah. in anything. With anything.
Yeah, and I think you see that in Prince. It's really just like I'm experimenting and I'm trying to find my voice. I'm breaking away from the social realism I was more immersed in before Prince. Mm-hmm. And as I moved away from that, it's the living proof is Prince where I just, you know, I go through different genres. I play around with humor. Mm-hmm. In school, in film school, I didn't even dare to make jokes because I was too nervous doing it, you know. And now I'm starting to feel more confident about mm-hmm. making movies. Also because, you know, I got some respect, I got some accolades, and that helps you, yeah, grow your self-esteem, which mm-hmm. is quite important as, you know, as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, my background.
That's good.
Yeah.
So wait, but were there like filmmakers that you... I don't know, were there any filmmakers that really kind of, like, you know, you were occupied with when you were a film student, like that you were just crazy about?
Yeah, in film school, I watched a lot of Dardenne's. Mm.
So, hence the social realism you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah.
I could see that. You know, there is a strain of it's sort of, well, just so people know, the Dardenne's, of course, are Belgian
yeah.
brothers who made many films, most recently... they finally actually cast a well-known actor for the first time.
Yeah, Marion Cotillard.
Right. It was the first time they kind of took a famous actress, Oscar-winning actress, to... I can see it with Prince, but then it sort of doesn't quite stay in that realm. It goes into a very quirky kind of a realm, and the music yeah. is a very big component of that, too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so that's what I mean when I say, like, I came from that more... I mean, we like, Maaike de Jong, she's a Dutch filmmaker. She's also strongly rooted in the social realism. So I really felt very influenced by
them.
Same
name?
Yeah, same last name.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
But she's no family. But it's... de Jong, it's like... it's Baker. Smith. Yeah.
Gotcha. Very funny.
So that's why I like it when people here say de Jong, it sounds exotic. Well, in the Netherlands, I'm like, you know, I'm yeah. the moderate guy. I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. I asked you about filmmakers that you really loved, and then Dardenne. You start from there, and then you discover, as you said, your own voice. And this guy, Prince, is, I guess, like kind of a, even though I don't remember hearing it as a nickname or something for Ayoub, who is your lead character. Ayoub,
yeah.
right, who is a young boy coming yeah. of age, in a sense, on the mean streets of Amsterdam, right,
yeah.
where
yeah.
it is the mean street, because it's like everybody, you know, they kind of get into little gangs, even if it's not a serious gang, there seems to be like a need to be a part of a group
yeah.
for one's own self-esteem. You create families like that, and also for safety purposes, perhaps, it's easier to run with a gang than by yourself, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of loneliness, it seems, too.
Yeah, even though he's surrounded by friends and, like, or gangs, whatever you call mm-hmm. it, or friends.
Friends, but I guess, you know, they all have their... It's kind of tough there, so that's why I didn't want to use the expression gang either, because it's not like they're really gang against gang in this movie.
Yeah.
It's more just their little cliques.
Yeah. But they're, like, I find that interesting at that age, you know, it's 16, 17, you form these brotherhoods, but you're so... preoccupied mm-hmm. about, you know, maintaining your front and your image, that you don't, on a spiritual level, really connect with your friends, and you have to act tough, you know, so you can't really mm-hmm. speak your heart out. Mm-hmm. And then, you see these two faces. You see him with his mother as a very kind and sweet and loving person.
He's really affectionate with his mother.
Yeah.
He loves
her.
A little exception. Yeah, and his sister. Apparently.
Yeah. And then you see him on the streets, and he tries to act up.
Well, you have to pose. To
yeah.
It's part of that, the growing up there, right?
Yeah.
You have to show that you're not a wimp.
Yeah. But even still, you know, if I'm in bigger groups, I'm not very good in bigger groups. I always get nervous.
Right.
I feel more comfortable being one-on-one or... Mm-hmm. And there's always
what was
this...
What was your childhood like? Was it similar? Or did you grow up like in anywhere near like these kids?
This is like... I grew up in a very small village. surrounded by meadows.
Oh, okay.
Quite picturesque, but it's 1K away from where we shot the movie.
Oh.
So, like, my video rental was there. Shopping was there. So I went to school in the center of the city. So I sort of traveled around, and I came to many different places and mm-hmm. subcultures. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't, like, bullied upon as the kid is in the film.
Or on the other side of it, too, gravitating towards a real like kind of a
crime,
right? He's Ayub is, because he's desperate, doesn't have any money, you know, he I guess wants to be liked and respected, so he ends up creating a relationship with a real criminal, a serious criminal who lives in the same area, right?
Yeah,
and becomes kind of a what would you say, he's like running errands for an errand boy.
Yeah, you know? He's like, yeah, disciple of this,
yeah,
kingpin, freak, geek.
Yeah. Who's often very high on
life.
and other
on
things.
On big blood.
Yeah, big blood, exactly. So tell me, and how did you find all these kids? Oh, the actors, I should say. And actresses, because there's a couple of very, very talented
The actors, like the actress that plays his mother, she's very well known in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. She's like this theater diva. I was very very excited that she wanted to cooperate because she had a very busy schedule. And as you know, all the main kids are amateur actors, first time actors, mm-hmm. and all over the place. I needed like a solid actress that you know would stick to her guns
and anchor the film.
Yeah, to anchor the film. And
yeah, sure.
Add this whole different level to it. You know, imagine her not being there. The film would have been a sort of gangster crime thing, and now it's like. Now it's a coming of age. It's about, you know, a troubled mother.
Dardanian, in a way.
Yeah,
yeah, more similar to that kind of thing, not to repeat that. But also, you know, she's a single mother, ostensibly raising Ayub as well as his sister or stepsister, is it?
Yeah.
Is it? Who's beautiful kid. And then there is a father in the picture, but he's an addict.
Yeah.
And whether it's self-imposed or he was thrown out, I'm not sure, but he's obviously living on the streets, more or less.
He's gone already. He's in a different realm.
Yeah, he's clearly in a downward spiral.
Yeah.
In fact, spends a lot of time in empty pools,
yeah,
which is, you know, an indication of just how low he's sunk.
Exactly. I mean, the film is full of sort of very straightforward metaphors and stuff,
yeah.
But I kind of like playing around with that.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
But it's also tragic.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the tone of the film, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to play also with, like, the iconography of certain things, you know. Like, a father that's a junkie and is near an empty pool. It's sort of almost a cliche, but at the same time, because it's so obvious, it becomes more than just a father figure, but a metaphor for a certain situation or a certain character. I still find it hard to explain what I mean with it, but...
And mom is trying to pull herself out, trying to find a man in her life, new partner, a healthy partner, somebody who's healthier and successful, right? She's sort of doing the online dating thing.
Yeah.
And then dad is, of course, as we already said, almost given up, if not, you know.
But both are preoccupied with themselves as well.
Okay.
I think. Like, she's not really aware of what's going on in her son's life.
That's true. Yes.
Which is logical, but she's not happy herself. And I think if you're not happy yourself, it's very hard to make sure others are happy. I mean, right? First,
yes,
you have to feel fulfillment in order to open up or something.
Right. That's true. Where did this film premiere?
It premiered in Berlin. It opened the Generations competition there. That's like... they say it's for youngsters, which is sort of... I mean, I don't think Prince is for youngsters. I think it's for all ages.
I'm not a youngster.
No.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It seemed very fresh, you know.
Yeah. But it was great. I mean, we premiered the film came about very quickly because a short film I made, I premiered at Berlin the year before that. And then I sat then and
there. Was that Magnesium or is that something else?
That's Marc Jacobs.
Oh, Marc Jacobs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I sat there and then okay, next year we'll be back with a feature. So I came back after Berlin. I started writing.
In 1 year?
Yeah, in a year, and then in 10
is that
days
true?
I had a... Huh?
You made... So in the space of 1 year, you were able to make a film like that? Make a feature?
Yeah. I started writing after Berlin, and then I said, let's shoot it in the summer, and we shot it in the summer.
Folks have to go to the Netherlands because clearly there's so much less red tape. You could just say, let's start a film, and everybody just gets together and does it. You know, yeah. There's not waiting and waiting and waiting.
Well, there's, I mean...
Raising money.
Things went very smooth for me. I mean, there's people, the directors in the Netherlands, some of them work for 7 years, you know, so...
Sure.
So, yeah.
So when did Vice come in, and what? How did that happen? Vice Media, which is... You know, become this huge
conglomerate.
It has, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're taking over Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've been up to those offices in Williamsburg.
I just saw their new office, yeah, and I was at the old office the day before that. It's impressive.
Oh, they have a new office?
Yeah.
Where's the new one?
The new one is closer. It's South 2nd Street.
Okay. Barry? No.
No.
White? So, Kent?
Between Kent and White.
Okay.
Near the Manhattan Bridge.
Right.
Yeah. It's beautiful. They have a huge garden with sunflowers. I don't know. They're doing well there.
Huh? I know. Maybe you can introduce me to folks. They could probably use a podcast. Like
yeah.
This, right.
On yeah.
Their network on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we'll see if that happens. Prince got to live through Vice Benelux. So Amsterdam.
Okay.
So Benelux. It's like Benelux is the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. We call it Benelux.
Okay.
But there's like basically Vice Netherlands. I think what Vice did is at a certain point, like, offices just started growing in different countries in Europe, and they were independent. They called themselves Vice, and they spread their content, but they worked autonomous. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I think now Vice, like, because they, I don't know the exact story, but mm-hmm. they are now all belong to Vice.
So, I see.
Yeah.
Right, they were autonomous, but now they've been brought back into once more, a little bit more streamlined and centralized. Okay.
So Vice Amsterdam decided to finance part of Prince, and then, yeah, as they started doing that, word got around here in New York that Vice Netherlands, you know, with Halal, the co-producer, they initiated it. That's the producer I've been working with for a few years, Gijs Kerbos.
And they're based in Amsterdam as well? Okay.
Yeah. But then Vice New York heard about it, and they wanted to see it, and they saw it, and they really liked it. And they sort of embraced the film, and mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason why, you know, mm-hmm. we started working with FilmBuff, and we have the opportunity to actually release this super small, low-budget film mm-hmm. To a broader audience around the world, which is something, you know... It's much better than I dreamt of when I said in Berlin a year back, okay, we're going to, you know, shoot a short film and next year we'll be back with a feature. I hadn't expected to go, you know, to turn out this way.
And then FilmBuff again is distributing here in the States, right?
Yeah.
So it's opening up in here in New York, at, as you said, the AMC Theater in...
It's in LA, it's in Denver, okay. It's on www.princethemovie.com. And at the same time, they're releasing it through VOD.
Right.
So it's been on iTunes for a while. You can pre-order it at iTunes. Times Warner, I believe. I don't know. This is all new to me and foreign, so I'm learning.
Well, you're doing a good job. You're doing a very good job as the spokesperson on the business side of it, right?
Yeah.
Because that's another thing you kind of really have to get more comfortable with as an independent film director. Right?
Yeah.
The team is pretty small.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to do a number of things yourself,
yeah.
right, in order to get the film out in the world and be the best ambassador for your film.
Yeah, although I had the luck of working with, you know, Halal, great producer.
Okay.
They did a lot of the business, so...
Yeah, okay.
But of course I hear about it, but I'm being protected. Like, I'm not, like...
You feel you're in good hands.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Okay, so, and have you met anybody that you're really blown away by? Like, in other words, anybody you're really impressed by? Did you meet anybody at the festivals that you were like, oh, my God,
Like Godard. Famous people?
I don't know. Maybe you met somebody. Maybe not even famous, but somebody, a filmmaker that you...
Yeah, I met a lot of like-minded people from my generation. I mean, Frances Bodomo, she...
Oh, I know her. She's been on the show.
Oh, really?
She's a friend of mine.
Ah, yeah.
I don't normally throw that around, but Frances did the... she did a couple of short films recently.
Afronauts, yeah.
Yeah, Afronauts. Yeah, I've had her on... Actually... I've done a few different things with her.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah, so
she's
I met...
She's lovely.
Like, yeah, she's great. And then Faisal Boulifa is another filmmaker who lives in London and Morocco. And then Vladimir de Fontenay, who lives in France and in New York, mm-hmm. and Dustin Guy Deffa, who lives...
Oh, I know Dustin.
Yeah, and then, yeah.
We're in a movie together, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had a number of scenes with Dustin. And I just did something else with him recently, actually, for another film in Cave Sahidi. He cast me in a little web series thing that he's doing.
Okay, awesome.
So with Dustin again.
He's shooting now, I think, his new feature.
Dustin, yeah. He was waiting for the money, but yeah. I'm sure he probably got it by now. And so, yeah. Did you see his family, what was it called, photo?
Person to Person?
No, short film where he redid the voice in slow, like kind of slow down the vocals, and he put it over family movies.
No.
Oh, my God.
Is it recent?
Four years ago. No, it's a short, but it's Family Nightmare, maybe it's called. It's like home movies.
Oh.
And they're all drunk, and they're all like loaded, and they're all like totally behaving inappropriately with each other, getting into fights, everything else. And but what he did, he took voices, he re-recorded dialogue. He did some other people, and they slowed down. It's really creepy, and you've got to see it. I'll find it, and I'll send you the link or something.
Yeah, I'll reach out to him. We're in touch.
Oh, you're friends. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But check it out. Prince is the name of the movie. The director is Sam DeJong.
DeJong.
And it's coming out Friday the 14th, probably the day that I'm putting this up, because I'm running very last minute here. But it's great meeting you, Sam.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a nice conversation. On. You have a chill and laid back.
Oh, thank you.
Swag.
Oh, wow. Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
It was really good meeting you.
Yeah.
Last up, Gina Lebrecht, who is describing the making of the films How to Smell a Rose, Happy Mother's Day, two classics with Ricky Leacock, Les Blank, all these wonderful pioneering verite filmmakers. And Gina was right in the trenches there with this, in this club, if you will. So right now, let's listen to my conversation with Gina Lebrecht. So let me make sure I Gina
Lebrecht.
Lebrecht. Oh, see, I would have mispronounced.
You were, that's
even
what you
I'm
were
pretty good. Say? No, it's not. I think I was going to say, how's it spelled?
It's L-E-I. It's actually. I might have
said Lebrecht.
Lebrecht, but
Lebrecht.
For some reason, it changed a few years ago.
Oh, what do you mean a few years ago? That's unusual.
It changed by itself. Honestly, it
really. Morphed?
When my last film that I made with Les came out in 2007.
Les Blank.
Mm-hmm. People started calling me Lebrecht. And I just went with it because it seemed easier and I actually had thought about it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been pronouncing it that way ever since.
Okay. So that's interesting because you were not like just a kid, you know? When you just... Because most people make those... Like a lot of people must know you as Lebrecht, but we can sort of cut it down the middle. Lebrecht. It's a pleasure to meet you. Maureen Gosling has been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Maureen.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. With your own history with Les Blank, you probably did run into her here and there, right?
Yes, absolutely. We've never worked together.
But... Oh, right. Understood. So what is your story first, and then how your relationship with Les came about?
Okay. Well, I studied film in college. I always wanted to be a filmmaker, and I worked on some feature films in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to the Bay Area. I moved to San Francisco in 1995, and I was trying to be a journalist. I wanted to write and take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, someone hired me to take some still photographs, a documentary filmmaker. hired me to take some still photos of a shoot that he was on, and I just had one of those light bulb moments.
Epiphanies.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching him work, and he was interviewing real people who had real stories, and they were using real natural light, and there were only three people on the crew, and I thought, this is it, and I never looked back. So I started a couple of projects of my own, and I never finished them, but I met Les in 1998, and he was going through a transition of his own at that point. He had transitioned to shooting digital, and he had just come back from China. And at that time, he was working alone in his office. His partners had sort of moved on because they finished up all their projects, and there was no funding coming in for anything, and Les was just sort of filming things with his new camera and didn't really have the means to deal with the material, so he gave it to me, and then we became collaborators.
Was editing ever part of what you were doing? Editing?
I wasn't an editor yet when I met Les, but through this project that he had shot in China, the All in This Tea, I became an editor. I remember one day, I organized all the footage, and then I said, well, Les, who's going to edit this film? And he said, you are.
And you're like, okay. Yes, yeah, that's right, I am.
I said, me? I thought he was going to hire Maureen to do it. And he just looked up at the ceiling, kind of rolled his eyes, and he goes, you can do it.
Right.
And it took me 8 years.
Really?
Yes. I wasn't working continuously for 8 years, but you know.
What were the films? So were the films that we're going to see at Film Forum? Or is that a little later?
That's later.
Okay. One was, Happy Mother's Day was shot in
63, excuse me. I think.
Okay. My birthday, 63.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so it's really just past its 50th birthday, that film, which is a charming film. But it's interesting. Let me finish. It's about a family who give birth to quintuplets, which was a national sensation at the time. They probably, in modern history, not, you know, maybe no other cases in the United States of that, and they all surviving.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
They all survived, all those kids?
They're all still alive, and...
I'm sure they're my age. God, you know...
They're your age.
Maybe a little older, but yeah.
The couple had already had five children.
Right.
Before that.
Oh, okay. That was a little confusing. Now that makes sense. Okay, yes, that makes... So they had 10 kids. Mm-hmm. Well, that in of itself, if for maybe, especially a Catholic family, dare I say, might not be, there are, you know, with a few Irish twins thrown in, it's probably not astonishing of itself. But so they had five individual birds and then one more litter.
Yes. They ended up divorcing, I hear. I don't know when that was, but.
They're divorced from reality, maybe, but. What's another funny little moment in it is this, speaking of litters, is the birth of these kittens, which is just, you know, just a little slice of life. But it's so funny because I believe there are five kittens in that litter, too.
Yeah.
Wasn't that funny?
Yeah, I thought that was such a wonderful little parallel.
Only in, as you said, in Verite documentaries.
It can only happen.
But it's interesting because another thread of the film, it really is about the media. And and its collaboration, in a sense, with, let's see, how shall I put it? Because it was like the town. What it was in Wisconsin? Where was this shot? I forget.
It was in South Dakota.
South Dakota. Excuse
one
me.
One of the Dakotas.
A Dakota. And really, if you're not from the Dakotas, is there a difference? I mean, Bismarck's in one of them, right? I think North Dakota is the capital of North Dakota.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter if you're from North or South Dakota and you're
Aberdeen,
listening.
Aberdeen, South Dakota. That's where it was.
Very good. Aberdeen. That's right.
Aberdeen.
You're right. Aberdeen. And that name just sounds so much like a Wisconsin name to me, but yeah. I digress. So, okay. Aberdeen, South Dakota. I don't want to insult anybody, but there's nobody from either Dakota listening to my show.
Probably not.
I've never met a filmmaker from either Dakota. I just haven't. I'm sure they exist. They're out there, but I haven't met them. Anyway. So, but it talks about the kind of collaboration between the marketing, which was like the local press and the local government mm-hmm. if you will, the local municipality.
Right.
It was like this opportunity to really draw a lot of attention to Aberdeen as well. Right. And so they kind of collaborated with the press and tried to, you know, really kind of, it's funny, you sit in one or two of these meetings about how they're going to exploit this situation to the best of the town, for the best of the town, et cetera.
Right.
It's a great little, I don't know, little film.
I think it really is. And there's, you know, there's a lot of irony there because there's Ricky and his partner on the film, Joyce Chopra, and they didn't want to be like the media. They didn't want to be intrusive. They didn't want to exploit this family.
This is Ricky Leacock?
Yeah, this is Ricky Leacock.
Okay, so maybe explain that too, that relationship then.
That was Ricky Leacock and Joyce Chopra, and okay, it was a Leacock Pennebaker production.
I know the two were, you know, working mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
Yeah, that may confuse my audience because they kind of jumped from Les to that film.
Mm-hmm.
But Les was involved in the other film, right?
How to Smell a Rose.
How to Smell a Rose. That's definitely Les.
Yeah, that's
But it's about Leacock in France.
Leacock. And there's a clip from Happy Mother's Day in the film, and then they decided to show Happy Mother's Day
I see.
With it.
Okay. You guys went to shoot How to Smell a Rose, which is an hour-long feature documentary, I suppose you could mm-hmm. say, which was about Ricky Leacock and mm-hmm. his lover or wife. Were they?
I don't believe they were married.
Me either.
They'd been together for years.
Yeah.
Valerie Lalonde.
Thank you. Valerie Lalonde. And anyway, they're living in France.
Yes.
Right? And you and Les went to France to shoot this documentary about Ricky's life in France, in this town?
Yeah, I think the intention was, as Les would say, just shoot home movies of Ricky living in this old farmhouse in Normandy.
Why? What was it that...
Well, I think it was actually a spontaneous decision because the 1 year earlier, mm-hmm. Les was in France for another reason.
Okay.
And he stopped in to visit his old friend Ricky.
Sure.
And they were sitting there in the kitchen, and I'm sure Ricky started telling all these stories that you see in the film.
Right.
And Les thought, oh, I really need to film this. And he always, you know, had admired Ricky and loved his cooking and loved his storytelling. So he borrowed Ricky's camera to film him, and he came back with some footage, and then he showed me that footage. And then a year later, I said, let's go back and film Ricky some more. And so we went back together, and we both filmed, and we got a lot of material, and we recorded more of these stories that he was telling and recorded him, you know, in his life out there in Normandy. And that's how that happened.
What were you thinking? Were you thinking who the audience was, or was that something that you guys discussed? Who would watch this? There wasn't really a distribution for these films at the time, right? It was mostly shown in maybe festivals, in institutionally. I don't know.
Films he made with Drew, they were all on
TV.
TV.
They were broadcast.
Yeah.
Was that the hopes? I mean, I guess it probably was, right? That you would broadcast these potentially?
Well, I think that, you know, every time I've gone into something mm-hmm. with Les, and also, you know, on my own projects, there isn't really that much intentionality or planning. I mean, I think it's more about just being curious and in the moment and seeing what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because having a camera in the room can often create a little magic. You know, people start opening up and talking. And it wasn't until, you know, it wasn't until later that it became apparent to me when I was editing the film, that this could be a really powerful educational piece. You know, it was as I was putting it together, I realized, oh, this is film history. It's not just Ricky telling stories.
You knew. I mean, okay, Leacock was an older man by this point, obviously, mm-hmm. right? He looks like
he's 78 at the
70s.
Time. Mm-hmm.
So he's already like a famous, world-renowned pioneer of documentary,
mm-hmm.
verite, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was him. There's like the Mount Rushmore at the time, right? Him and Leacock and Pennebaker.
Pennebaker, Maisels.
Les Blank, I guess, was a kid by comparison, maybe a generation behind.
Yeah, he was 13 years younger yeah. than Ricky and came a little after. So
right, it's kind of horrifying how quickly they're all disappearing. Now that I think about it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very lucky to have had a number of them on, though, as a sidebar. Albert did the show a few years ago.
Nice.
And also Penny. Mm-hmm. And Chris Hedges. Yeah, but I was a little late on Les Blank, unfortunately. I really would have liked to have met him. What kind of guy was he?
Well, he was...
Complicated?
He could be. He had his moments. Mm-hmm. But he was a very soft-spoken, kind of quiet, but very curious person. And he was, he had this gift of making people, I think, feel seen. Something about his presence created like a space where people could reveal themselves, because he just had this sense of curiosity and he wasn't judgmental, really. And you can see it in his films, and he had that effect just, you know, personally, too. If you were having dinner with him, he had this way of making you feel like you were the only person in the room.
That's nice. Was there an ego? You were in a small company of female documentary filmmakers, I assume, right? I mean, I don't know who your contemporaries were. There was, I mean, Barbara Cockle, I guess, was already had already made Harlan County, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a couple of others, and there was Shirley Clark doing something a little bit more experimental, but
right.
But I mean, who were there? Like, did you feel a bit in the shadow? Did you struggle with that? And maybe still do. It's still a very dominated field, male dominated field, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And yes, I do feel like I'm in less of shadow, but I always kind of liked being there. It didn't bother me.
Yeah.
Now he's gone. The shadow's still there, but not so much. And it's, you know, it's a little uncomfortable for me. I don't feel that when I make a film, it's not about me. I don't really care. I don't need to be the center of attention because it's in the film. You know, the film is what's important, and I will do whatever I have to support the film. You know,
the film is the thing,
mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it never bothered me that I was in less a shadow.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see if it just went on for years and years and years, it would start bothering
sure.
me.
Yeah.
You know, but he's gone now, and I really miss him. Mm-hmm. I wish he was here, and I would much rather share this experience with him.
Yeah, I'm sure. Did you get a chance to see A Poem as a Naked Person? And
oh, yeah, I've seen it many times.
Yeah. Did you see it with him?
Yeah, I actually did some editing on it for him.
Or is that right? I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. So catch me up a little bit in terms of what you've been doing, you know, since these films. Although I do want to say How to Smell a Rose, Happy Mother's Day. Are there any that I'm missing? Or is it just... It's basically How to Smell a Rose... And the companion piece is Happy Mother's Day.
Yeah, for this run at Film Forum.
Film Forum, those two films, which together probably add up to about 80 plus minutes, right?
Exactly.
And you'll be there at Film Forum. Well, you will have been there. I think I'm tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I'll be there.
This
tonight.
Is not a live show. I'm catching up. So you're going to go there tonight, and you're going to meet your audience. Is there anybody else hanging out or coming to do any Q&As with you, or?
Yes, Ricky's daughter, Victoria Lee Cockhoffman, is going to be doing the Q&A. And then Pennebaker and Chris Hedges are going to be there doing the Q&A.
So. Fantastic, fantastic.
Yeah.
They're so good. And he is still very boyish, and as we know.
Yeah.
And it's great. He's still running around, and they have a new film, I know, I've heard, right?
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody has, but they've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah, they have.
So catch me up a little bit. What are your, do you teach or do you, it's filmmaking?
I work, as an editor in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay.
I freelance. I work on lots of different projects. I'm working on a companion piece for this film on Ricky Leacock. I did some interviews a couple of years ago with D.A. Pennebaker and Robert Drew.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Maisels. And I wanted to do a companion piece that was more interview based and went and showed a different perspective of Ricky's story, and maybe goes a little deeper into the making of Primary. And I was lucky that I got to interview Bob Drew, because 6 months later we lost him. Right. And I was lucky that I got to meet Al Maisels, because he followed not long after. And I also would like to interview some of Ricky's former students at MIT, and just do a little short, you know, piece mm-hmm. about how Ricky influenced the following generations of filmmakers. I'm also, for the last 17 years, I've been working on a film about Les.
Oh, okay.
So I've been filming him since we went to France to film Ricky. I started filming Les at that same moment.
So you were shooting The Shooter.
I was shooting The Shooter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I filmed him over the years, and then he got sick in 2012. And I filmed him a little bit at the beginning of his illness, but as he got sicker, I just, yeah. I couldn't film him. But his son, Herod, filmed him for that entire year of his
right.
illness.
He did the podcast with Maureen recently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I hate to keep plugging myself, but I, you know, it's for the listeners. They can go find the show if they're interested with Al mm-hmm. Maisels and mm-hmm. Pennybaker and Hegedus and all these folks. It's nice.
So I'm basically, after Les died, I asked Herod to collaborate with me on the project.
Terrific.
So we're working together on...
He seems to be a real character.
Yep.
Yeah, he was very, very warm, very friendly guy. Oh, yeah. Moving on to, you know, maybe your more some where your contemporaries, are there other documentary filmmakers that you are particularly fond of? One thing I wanted to mention when you were talking about Les being sick and the sensitivity of shooting that, did you happen to see One Cut, One Life? Lucius Smalls.
Absolutely. And I did see that.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of that? Because that certainly goes, not only does it deal with filming
Ed Pincus,
of course, but he's of course collaborating on the film, but it goes into the complications and the sensitivities when you're shooting something and the family is losing the person because they're collaborating and taking up a lot of time that which they only have a little left
mm-hmm.
and how painful that was for Ed's wife.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it was a bit of a love triangle, I guess.
Sure.
Even if he wasn't having an affair with her, but still there was a deep connection there, and that could, you know, was threatening to the wife, which is understandable. I was really struck by a lot of the parallels there. And I mean, the reason I couldn't film Les was because he was my friend first, and I felt the need to be present with him through his illness. And the camera for me was created a remove. And I didn't want that to be my last memories of Les was looking at him through a lens. I wanted to really be with him. Herod didn't feel that way. You know, everybody deals with it differently. For him, that was how he dealt with it, you know, was by looking at Les through the camera and capturing whatever he could with the little bit of time that was left. And that was how we ultimately got that interview with Les that's at the beginning of How to Smell a Rose, where he talks about his relationship with Ricky and why he wanted to make that film.
Mm.
That was shot only a few weeks before he died.
Hmm. Well, thanks for being so upfront about it. It's obviously a real sensitive subject, you know. All that and your relationship with him. I thought that I think because of the Ed and Lucia's relationship was so much based on filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so was yours and Les's. I don't know how much I can, but you're right when you say it. You said it perfectly. Everybody handles that type of process very personally and in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So if I may ask, did you feel that you were able to have that time with him and that you got, that it was meaningful for you and him?
I did, but of course it's never enough. You always want more time.
Sure.
You know, but I got what I could, and I think that it was the right thing to just, I think I did the right thing. Plus I was caring for him. You know, I was organizing a cooking circle, you know, so he could have meals delivered. And I was, when I visited him, I really just wanted to make him comfortable. Like, what can I do for you today? You know?
That sounds like being very much in the minute, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't want the camera there. It was just going to distract me.
Right.
And of course I was worried that I didn't have enough footage for my film. And, you know, I panicked. But what are you going to do? I mean, the situation was out of my control, and Herod was filming him, so I had to accept what was happening and hope for the best.
Well, look forward to whatever it looks like one day. I can't wait. And we'll, you'll come back on and hopefully this thing and talk about that show, that film, excuse me.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Well, thank you. And again, How to Smell a Rose and Happy Mother's Day are at the Film Forum right now. Hurry up and get over there. How long are you going to be in New York?
I'll be here through tomorrow, Thursday.
Okay. And are you heading back west, or are you going to?
I'm going back to San Francisco, yeah.
Okay. Is it going to get a run there, too?
I believe so. We have Kino Lorber is our distributor.
Oh, and that's right.
They're planning a theatrical run across the U.S.
Oh, very good. Lovely meeting you.
Thank you. Thanks. Nice meeting you.
Okay, guys, I'm going to keep the outro here pretty short. I'm always fighting the fight against time. It's my biggest enemy these days, doing a lot of work, and I don't have a lot of time to do my editing and the posting of the show, all those things that that's why you're seeing little. Of course, it is the summer. It's late August now, or mid-August, I should say. And, you know, I need a little bit of a break. And so, you know, if we're winding down, we're winding down. But let me just say that you can get, we will be posting the Jerry Schatzberg show. And then I've also got segments with the filmmaker, Oren Moverman, coming up shortly, who has a new film starring Richard Gere, Ben Vereen, Keir Sedgwick, and the Buscemi brothers, Steve and Michael, in smaller roles, but they're all in this film. Richard Gere, homeless, mentally ill, incredible. Director Oren Moverman coming up. The name of the film is Time Out of Mind, and that comes out on the 9th of September. Oren will be here for that. And okay, so when I went to meet Oren Moverman up at the offices at IFC Films, which, you know, I'm up there not infrequently. I go up there occasionally. So I'm up there, and, you know, we're hanging out in the little lounge area waiting for my turn to talk to Oren. And I see Richard Gere walking into the room. He's walking it by. And I had seen him pass a few minutes earlier, but this time he's coming right into the lounge. And he smiles at me. I smile back. And he comes over. He goes, "How do we know each other?" And it was the weirdest thing. It's not that I have a lot of people that famous on my show. I don't have that number of people, big number of people. I'd like to, but you know, I do meet them pretty frequently. And the weirdest thing happened. He reaches, like I said, he says, "Do we know each other?" And I said, "Yeah." And then I said, "What are you saying yeah for, you dummy? You're going to be caught in a lie." So I quickly said, no, I'm just kidding. No, I'd like to. And I'm thinking to myself, why are you saying these words? Stop saying these words. They're weird, Chartoff. You're tripping over yourself. You're embarrassing yourself. But I shook his hand. I smiled. I said, I get that all the time. You know, which is, in fact, true. Every day that I'm out and about and I'm meeting new people, almost every single time that happens, somebody says to me without fail, "You look familiar to me. I don't understand it. Have we met? How do we know each other?" We, you know, I get this all the time. and I do know that there's a phenomenon. I just have a familiar face. So it could be. I don't know. I don't know. It just happens so frequently to the degree that I no longer, I look at it as a phenomenon, not as a coincidence, you know? But Richard Gere, what a nice guy. And did have that thing, you know, that you hear about, this aura, this sort of vibrant energy, whatever you want to call it, that emanates us to some degree. I don't want to make too much of a fuss about it. But when you meet him and he looks at you and he smiles, you feel like you're being sort of, there's a shroud of something around you, you know? And it's that kind of like that Bill Clinton thing. You're the only guy in the room. You're the only guy, you know? He makes you feel that way. Richard Gere's genuine smile. I mean, I can't say much more than that. We only met for possibly 6 seconds, 7 seconds, 8 seconds. I don't know. It was brief, but it seemed like really, it was really neat, you know? I was upset because I told the publicist, why didn't you let me know? 10 minutes with Richard Gere, would that have killed you? Well, we only have so much time. I get it. But you know what? Here I am, time and time again. I stick my neck out. I do the job. I'm in the trenches with these filmmakers. Throw me a bone, you know? I got Oren Moverman coming on. This is a guy I want to talk to. We had a fantastic conversation. But you know, I could talk to Richard Gere and have a deep conversation with Richard Gere. This is a, you know, he's an icon. How many times has he been to the top of the Hollywood movie mountain, you know, in his career? He's had so many huge films that you don't even really think about it anymore. He keeps coming back. Well, Time Out of Mind. It's out at the New York Film Festival, and you're not going to believe it. I mean, maybe you've heard, this is an Oscar bid. He's playing a homeless guy, you know, and he's mentally ill. Well, let me tell you something. The truth is that this film is small. Not a lot of people. It's not going to be in a lot of theaters. And it's made on a small scale. I don't even understand it, like how he got to do this film, you know, because it's not like it's got a happy ending. It's not a feel-good movie. So, you know, this is an interesting film. I'm kind of curious. We did talk about it, Oren and I, about, like, how do you make a movie like this size, you know, with a major Hollywood actor? So tune in for that. Also coming up on the same episode will be my conversation with the actress Mickey Sumner, who is, you know, the daughter of Gordon Sumner and Trudy Styler. Gordon Sumner, of course, is also known as Sting, which is pretty cool. Despite the uncoolness factor of saying you like Sting, I do. I think he's probably, maybe he's arrogant and whatever and pretentious, but most of the music that I've heard, I really liked. I liked a number of his solo albums, so I would love to have him on too. But Mickey Sumner is in a new movie called The Mend, and the filmmaker, director, John McGarry, will be on with her. So I'm going to be talking to Mickey and John on that same episode coming up. And so much more coming up, you know. So continue to listen to the show, folks, because we're going to keep doing great episodes. So thank you for listening to this episode. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is FilmWax Radio. Until next time, take care.
Take the sky, for example, a canvas of a billion suns. But our local hero shines them out by day, save for the winking of a Venus or Mars.